I'm Tyler Smith.
And I'm Alexandria Hadara. Welcome to Global Takes, America's number one podcast discussing global issues from the Black perspective.
It's time for our voices to be at the forefront of foreign politics and innovation. This is Global Takes.
Catastrophic situation is playing out in Australia.
The smoke visible from space.
A New Year's Eve crisis going into 2020.
People are telling us this is the worst they've ever seen. The fires have burned more intensely, more ferociously. They seem to have a mind of their own.
Satellite imagery is showing that Arctic sea ice is at its lowest levels on record.
In northern Siberia, it hit 100.4 degrees.
We are looking right now at the all-time record.
Climate change is real, folks. It is time for world leaders to pay attention and do something about it. Gas prices are up. Summers are harder. Winters are short. We all remember Katrina and Hurricane Sandy and all the other hurricanes that followed after. I live in Maryland, and you can see year after year how we have been getting less snow in the D.C. area. Hurricanes and floods are becoming the norm in coastal cities. Today, we're going to talk to Dr. April Baptiste from Colgate University to discuss the effects of climate change in the Black community, particularly as it relates to the Caribbean. This is Global Take.
Thank you so much again for having me, Alexandra. I really appreciate it. You know, my career, I would say, started, you always start with your background, right? Because that childhood kind of sets the basis for your interest even before you realize that you have that interest. And so, you know, I grew up, I'm Trinidadian by birth. And so I grew up in Trinidad and Tobago in a rural community. And interestingly, that rural community was also an oil drilling community. So, you know, we were situated among, they call them pumping jacks in Trinidad, which is basically the oil rig that you would use that you you put on the cap of an oil well. And so I grew up agricultural, lots of trees around me. My favorite memories are climbing fruit trees, those kinds of things. So I think that that kind of set the stage and the affinity for loving the physical environment and just having a lot of interest in that. But again, I bring up the oil and gas fields because you have, you know, a poor agricultural community that's juxtaposed with, you know, oil and gas drilling. And so you have children like myself, you know, between the ages of 5 and 11 that walk through, you know, these particular areas and you smell that fume. And you know that it's not normal, right? But at the same time, you're like, okay, well, maybe this is just normal. This is just life, etc. So I would say that kind of sort of the basis piqued my curiosity in the physical environment, the physical space, the love for the environment, but then also some of the negative impacts that might have been part of the environment. But of course, that realization didn't come till my PhD.
What are the main climate issues in the Caribbean? Just so our viewers know, like, why this climate change is so important in the Caribbean region.
Yeah, you know, right now, as I, you know, in class yesterday, I was telling my students that in my generation, growing up in high school and probably early, you know, college days, the thing about the environmental issue that we were focusing on was the ozone layer. Right. And, you know, the Montreal Protocol and those kinds of things, the things that they of their generation now is climate change. And I think for the most part, we're past the idea of doubting whether climate change is a thing. Now we're at that stage where we're saying, OK, climate change is here. We're experiencing the impacts. And I think that the Caribbean, why it's an important region to pay attention to is because of how it is situated, right? So it's geographically in the Caribbean Sea, you know, with the Atlantic Ocean to the right. And when you think about it, you think about, well, what are the impacts that these small island developing states are facing? And the biggest is sea level rise right now. We see it, for example, on the north coast of Jamaica, places like Negril, for example. When I was doing my sabbatical day in the 2012-2013 academic year, you would hear people complaining about the beach erosion, the significant beach erosion, and they would call it beach erosion, but we know that a significant amount of that would have been due to sea level rise, starting to take place slowly. Barbados also have some issues with sea level rise. And so sea level rise is slow, but you're starting to see the impacts now. You know, over the decade that I've been doing this work, you're starting to hear more and more people talk about sea level rise. The second, I think, which is really important, is drought. Drought has always been a problem, but the intensity and I would say the frequency of drought within the Caribbean, has definitely within the last couple of decades have been a problem. And of course, with drought, you have, you know, the rippling effects of negative agricultural impacts that can impact food security and food sovereignty issues. You also have water problems, right? So portable access to potable water, and then water for everyday use, etc. So you have drought that I think is really important. And that's where the farming literature and climate change have really highlighted for us over the years. Floods, again, have also been a significant. Now you would say, well, how could you have both drought and floods, right? That doesn't seem to make sense, but it does, because you have this unpredictability in weather, in weather patterns. And then what you end up with is that in the moments of our rainy season, sometimes you get these significant downpours for days on end that could then lead to the floods. And then you have the elevated during the dry season, those elongated periods of drought, which I think is why the two can coexist in the same sentence. And then finally, storms and hurricanes. Even though Trinidad and Tobago, where I'm from, is outside of that hurricane belt, that doesn't prevent us from experiencing storms. So for example, within the last couple of years, Trinidad have actually been on tropical storm warning much more frequently than, for example, when I was growing up, right? We would have never been hit by a tropical storm. And of course, we would have seen, you know, the 2005 major hurricane season with Hurricane Ivan and a number of other Category 5 storms. But then also 2017, right, which is the one that in most recent memory with Hurricane Irma and Maria that really devastated the northeastern part of the Caribbean. So storms themselves are problematic, and then you have that rippling effect. So those are the four that I would list, I would say, in terms of sort of the environmental impacts of climate change that are really being materialized right now within the Caribbean context.
Wow, that's quite intense. I mean, I just go to my time in New Orleans. That's when I was really exposed to this issue. What is it like living in the Caribbean and knowing that, okay, during hurricane season, this could be it? Like, is that traumatic, particularly like for Black communities in Latin America and the Caribbean?
Yeah, I actually think so. It's two, right? You living in the Caribbean, you know that hurricanes and storms are a part of life, right? And so, you know, each country within the Caribbean will have their own disaster preparedness office, which is most likely in like the Ministry of Environment, for example. It's in Trinidad and Tobago. So each country will have disaster preparedness, right? Similar to like a FEMA. And so those organizations will ensure that they prep, you know, hurricane season is coming. They're going to say, okay, you need to prepare your home, make sure that your home is hurricane ready, make sure that you have the things to shutter up. If we go on hurricane warning, you'd shutter up your windows, those kinds of things. So there is a certain amount of preparedness. I think that within the last few years, at least when I want to say consciousness, like aware. Right. Because as a child, you kind of go through the motions. But as a young adult and, you know, a young professional now, you kind of know that people do pay attention. You have people that pay attention. Now, there are some individuals that pay attention, but can't. This is where environmental justice come in. They may not be able to afford to be able to actually prepare. And so that's where the disconnect comes in. Right. So you can tell me that I need to prepare. I say I'm aware that I have to prepare, but if I don't have the resources to be able to prepare, then it leads to a different level of trauma, right, within individuals. And that's where, you know, with people ending up in shelters. So that's the one level, right, that there is awareness. You have to deal with the preparedness. The other side is the notion of the back-to-back trauma. So I think, for example, of a Puerto Rico that was hit by both Hurricane Maria and Hurricane Irma within a couple weeks of each other, right? That I think was particularly traumatic, because even before the communities had the ability to be able to recover, here they go and they will hit again. And it's of no fault of their own, right? The hurricane isn't targeting Puerto Rico. The country is just located in the path of storms. And so what it raises is, how do we build resiliency within these communities that allow them to be able to withstand some of these back-to-back pressures that are environmental, that they have no control over the pathway of the storm? So I think that that's where some of the trauma comes in, right? Trying to be able to deal with the back-to-back impacts, and then also trying to recover, right? So we saw this in Dominica. Their prime minister went on the world stage, and he basically said, you know, that Maria devastated Dominica, and we need, you know, the international aid to be able to recover, because for an island that's highly dependent on tourism, if they don't get that infrastructure back up and running, how is it that they're able to get the economy up and going? So I think that there are these different levels of trauma that individuals would be able to will have to deal with within Caribbean societies.
Wow. And speaking of that, like with Dominica, I know, like, in particular, and also with Jamaica, they signed, did they sign the Paris Agreement? Did Dominica, I'm not sure if they signed the Paris Agreement.
Most likely.
Many countries did sign the Paris Agreement, and that sought to, as a guide to treatment of climate change and by limiting the rise of global temperatures below 2 degrees Celsius. Mm-hmm. I was just curious to know, like, by signing these international treaties, the United Nations, do these international treaties actually target marginalized groups, like particularly Black communities in the Caribbean and in Latin America? And if they are effective, because like you said, there's a lot of trauma that, especially having to deal with back-to-back hurricanes. Mm-hmm. I hardly see those images of Black people suffering from Latin America, more from Haiti and maybe Jamaica, predominantly Black countries. But I was just curious to know, like, what these international treaties do as it relates to, you know, really targeting marginalized groups.
Mm-hmm. You raise an interesting, before I get to the policy piece, you raise an interesting question about, you know, the images that come on quote unquote US or mainstream media, right? Most people, when they look at Black communities within the Caribbean context, they focus on the Haitian context, right? And we know that Haiti has, you know, it's a beautiful country. I've been multiple times. You know, it's our first Black republic in the Western Hemisphere, and have paid severely for that tremendous feat. And so it is really problematic, right? And Haiti, you know, has suffered. It's in the corridor of storms. So hurricanes completely wipe them out. But you have that history of the colonial past that has also devastated, right? And has just never allowed Haiti to be able to recover, right? And to get their economy really up and going. And so the suffering in Haiti, while it's important, we need to focus on, doesn't always reflect the broader Blackness within the Caribbean context, and which is why I focus on, you know, the Caribbean region, because for me, and I try to separate the Caribbean from Latin America. It's not that Latin America isn't important, but often Latin America and the Caribbean get swamped into each other. And then when you talk about Latin America and Caribbean, you hear about Haiti, you hear about the Dominican Republic, you hear about Puerto Rico, but you don't hear about Dominica, you don't hear about Barbados, you hear about Jamaica because everybody knows about Mali. But there are, you know, 26 other countries within the region, you know, that are predominantly Black. And so and face a number of different issues. So thanks for elevating that, you know, and saying, you know, that you only hear about these small, handpicked contexts within the media context. So the question about international treaties is a policy question, and I'm going to give the caveat that I'm not a policy expert at all. It's not even in my area of expertise. But what I would say from thinking about the policy frameworks and thinking about, you know, the way in which I don't know if we necessarily need international treaties, but they seem to be gestures, right? So on the one hand, for me, they're sort of these symbolic gestures, right, that are used to give that sense of urgency, that the problem is being addressed. But on the other hand, we need to ask about enforceability, because you can't have a treaty without enforceability. And the problem with international treaties is the enforceability piece. So you can have all of these nation states, the 190 plus nations that come and ratify a treaty, but who's holding who accountable at the end of the day? And I think that has always been the problem with these particular treaties. That's the first thing. The second thing, which gets to probably the heart of what you're trying to examine, is this idea of targeting, right? And whether Black communities or Black countries tend to face the heavier burden. And I do think that they do to a large extent. I think that in my opinion, again, I'm not a policy expert, but in my opinion, it places a heavier burden on those that are not responsible to be able to address the problem under the guise of assisting with adaptation and building resiliency within these nation states. So when you have something like a Green Development Fund that is proposed, that we're going to put billions of dollars into these green development funds, and look, you developing countries, you can come and get access to this funding. But access to the funding comes with conditionalities, and those conditionalities are so that the carbon offsets benefit the developed world, or those, you know, funding nations. And I think that itself is sort of problematic, because small island development states like the Caribbean, the emissions levels are so low, right? With the exception of Trinidad and Tobago, that is an oil producing nation. And still, even an oil producing nation within the context of these larger countries still have a smaller emission rate, but you still wanna, acknowledge that. So I think that, as Caribbean communities, we kind of have to, you know, take a step back and really examine what the purpose of these treaties are. You know, is it continuing to keep us in the state of dependency, even as we try to build resiliency, as we try to build adaptation? Because we have to adapt, we have to become resilient, right? These are our home. We don't have extra land like the United States to, you know, say, okay, if our coast is flooded, we can move inland. No, if the coast is flooded, then the inland is flooded, right?
Thought about that.
Yeah, we don't have extra land. I mean, a country like a Trinidad and Tobago is 4,000 square kilometers. So it's very small. Once you start losing land, you start asking yourself, well, where do we go? And is it that the former colonizers are going to say, hey, you know, Trinidadians, Tobagonians, Dominicans, y'all could come to England, y'all could come to the United States. You see all of the drama that goes on with immigration issues. So, you know, it really becomes really complicated when these treaties themselves don't have a lot of teeth for enforceability, and or, you know, really begs the question of whether it leaves nation states like Caribbean islands in a state of dependency.
Wow, you've said a lot there, so I have time to unpack. I'm really happy to be a part of your classroom today. I've learned so much. I guess one thing I want to unpack is just the focus on which Caribbean countries are getting that international attention when it comes to like the foreign aid to help countries that have been devastated from these hurricanes and other climate change issues. So when I think about that, like I'm thinking about like your Puerto Rico, your Dominican Republic, and I think about like even the larger diaspora in the United States. There is a large, very influential immigrant community of Puerto Ricans and Dominicans and Cubans, yes, in America. So it's easier for them to get that assistance. So I'm just curious to know, like, what role do the Black diasporans that are coming from the Caribbean, what role have they played in bringing attention to these issues, particularly as it relates to Haiti or Dominica? Mm-hmm. Do they play a big role in trying to garner that international attention that's needed?
Yeah, definitely. I think the diasporic community is really important. So, mm-hmm. You know, the first would be, for example, when we think about, again, going back to Puerto Rico, you know, the Puerto Rican population in New York City, they rallied together in order to get donations and then send those donations to their home country. In a lot of ways. And those were the aid, et cetera, that made it to communities, because we saw the whole debacle with the federal government and FEMA really messing up some of that response. You know, with Haiti, it's the same thing. You know, you have a large Haitian population in Miami, and they're actively involved in sort of sending remittances back home, right? And sort of addressing, or at least trying to raise the concern of Haitians, right? You know, recently I had a faculty member came and she gave a talk, and she was talking about the way in which Haitian migrants, and of course she's alluding to the fact that this is race related, Haitian migrants are often seen as economic migrants, and they're not, you know, categorized under the notion of refugee. And we really need to start, you know, thinking of Haitian migrants as refugees, right? Because being a refugee is not an easy thing. And because they're categorized as economic migrants, they get pushed back, you know, and deported, et cetera, which is really problematic. So you're sending them back to environmental crises, you're sending them back to political crises, et cetera. And so I think that the diasporic community is important in order to keep some of these issues at the forefront. So they're important for keeping the issues at the forefront, they're important for sending remittances, and they're important for attempting to send aid when they are able to, right? And that's where some of their remittances comes in as well. So I think that the diaspora is really important in order to address some of the issues that we see, both from an environmental but also from a social perspective.
I mean, that's wow. And because I always think about like the immigration side in terms of like, are these countries like particularly Western countries, are they looking, it would be to their advantage to like at least help the Caribbean and other countries with this climate change crisis, just for prevention of immigration. We're always like, oh, we don't want, you know, foreigners at our borders. And that's a selfish reason, but I'm just thinking like, and then immigrants, while they want to flee the United States for economic reasons, they don't want to leave their home, their culture, their people, their, I mean, it's more of like a necessity. It's kind of like, we just don't have a choice. So just curious to know, is the climate change fight, are they kind of looking at this from a migration standpoint?
I am not sure if they're there for the Caribbean as yet, that the fight for climate change, you know, part of the literature talks a lot about climate refugees. So, you know, I do work on small island developing states, even though I'm not, you know, a Pacific Ocean, you know, Indian Ocean type expert, the Maldives and Tuvalu were two of the nation states, small island developing states, that were really important in pushing the conversation about climate refugees, because they're such low-lying states and face, you know, basically loss of their homelands. And so they have even gone so far as to, you know, explore purchasing land, you know, in Australia, in other countries that would be open to allowing them to be able to purchase land. Now, again, don't know how far those conversations are, if it was just symbolic or how serious they were, but they have thought about that, right? Thinking about, okay, maybe we need to look to purchase land elsewhere because we're going to lose our homeland. I have not heard those kinds of conversations and framing of climate change within the Caribbean. we hear a lot about climate justice within the Caribbean, with the notion of recognizing that there is low emission rates within the low emission rates from these countries, and yet significant impacts. And so there is this idea that we are suffering from the brunt of the burden, and so therefore we need to be able to get access to whatever international funding is out there to be able to adapt, because most Caribbean people want to stay within their countries. The immigration question is more complicated, right? Because there are individuals like myself. I'm an immigrant, right? I came to the United States. I studied, etc. And then I was offered, a tenure track position at my university. And so here I am as an immigrant. Whereas you may have someone else that may had to flee for economic reasons, right? I made the choice. I could have gone back to my country, etc., and served at the university there. I made the choice to stay and work here. And there are benefits associated with that for my country, but also for my my family, etc. So immigration, hasn't sort of tied into the climate debate as yet for the Caribbean from a climate refugee perspective. I think that the research probably may end up going there. One of my colleagues, did some work on Haitian migrants in the Bahamas and the way that they were treated after Hurricane Dorian, where there was a significant amount of deportation of Haitians from the Bahamas. And I think that's where the literature is going to eventually go when you start thinking about immigration issues, migration issues, and climate change. But I think right now it's still relatively new in linking those two together within the Caribbean context.
Wow, that's quite interesting. So the Bahamas were not doing any better than the United States. And then speaking of that, what about organizations like CARICOM and Organizations of American States, OAS? Are they doing anything in terms of helping Black communities in Latin America and the Caribbean deal with this, the economic impact of climate change? Have you seen any developments?
Again, I think for me, the CARICOM, the Caribbean community, they do have the 5 C's, right? Which is the Caribbean Community Climate Change Center, and that's based in Belize. The issue is that I haven't heard a lot of the work that they're doing, right? And the caveat with that is that they do work at the regional level and they work a lot with the governments. So I suspect that they have a lot of conversations going on with governments. So for example, in a reactive kind of way, when hurricanes happen, if there are major earthquakes, those kinds of things, they would come in, they would provide aid, those kinds of things. And they even have those diplomatic conversations, right, about how should the region maybe address climate change. Mm-hmm. That have not been, I would say, filtering down to the local level. So, as a scholar, I focus on the local level, right? The fishers, the community level, that kind of thing, and their perceptions. And so there are other scholars that focus kind of like at the governmental level, and then others that will focus at the regional level. So not because I haven't heard mean that they aren't doing stuff. They probably are doing really interesting things, but I'm not as aware of them. And the same thing with OAS, larger organization, incorporates some of our Latin American counterparts there, but really haven't heard a lot of that political discourse going on. But I suspect that they're doing a lot of the treaties type thing, trying to figure out how as a region we're going to address climate change.
And speaking of that, I know with your research, I know you explore the effects of climate change with Caribbean fisher communities. And that is it's a big profession, or that's a big industry that a lot of Black Jamaicans participate in. I was just wondering if you can kind of discuss briefly, I know you have extensive research on that issue, and just talk about how the Jamaican government is responding to the climate issues affecting local local fishing communities?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in a nutshell.
Ooh, in a nutshell.
my research, you know, it's you know, wide. But one of the things that I would say is that my research sort of focused on the perceptions of fishers to climate change, because I was really interested, and I still am very interested, in whether the local average everyday person is aware of climate change, aware of this concept of climate change, right? So as academics, as the scientific community, we're well aware, we know what we mean by climate change, but what do the everyday person know about climate change, and what does that mean to them, particularly as they're suffering the consequences? And so that's the entry point for my fishers research. And it is telling, because when you go into the fishing community, and I've done this in Trinidad, Tobago, and Jamaica, when you go into the fishing community, it is clear that they are aware that there are these changes, environmental changes, that they don't categorize just as ebbs and flows, right? That there is something different that's taking place. One of the big consequences that they have mentioned was fish migration patterns. So they said, you know, well, you know, the fish are no longer coming, you know, we're not getting the same types of fish, you know, in the warm waters, or we may be seeing, you know, fish that would normally be in temperate waters coming down into this particular area. And of course, they're not scientists, so they can't explain that, you know, and I'm not a fish expert, so I can't really explain that. But that's one of the things that they talked about. They talked about the change in temperatures, which we know the science has, you know, corroborated that, right? And they clearly see that. They talk about unpredictability in weather patterns, which again is corroborated by the science. And the unpredictability in weather patterns is important for them because they're relying on their local indigenous knowledge of weather patterns to be able to go out and fish. And so they now no longer can rely on that. And so they find themselves either having to listen to, you know, sort of the weather bulletins a little bit more often, just to double check and make sure that their local knowledge can be corroborated, those kinds of things. So you have sort of, you know, those are some of the interesting things that they mentioned. And even some of them were aware of the causes of climate change, right? They may not necessarily tell you, you know, that it's fossil fuels and hydrocarbons and all of that, but they mention that it is, you know, because of, you know, the carbon emissions, you know, that's leading to climate change. So I think that going into that research over the years, I really wanted to be able to elevate that there is this thing called local knowledge that's important to recognize, and that we need to tap into that local knowledge in order to build adaptation, coping, and mitigation strategies for climate change, right? And not just see our, you know, most vulnerable parts of our community as just uneducated and unwilling to be able to adapt, because I think that that's a myth that needed to be sort of squashed. In terms of the response from the Jamaican government, I know that, again, policy level, which, you know, I could only talk about from, you know, cursory. The significant thing that happened, I think, in 2013, and I'm not sure if they have restructured, was that climate change became part of the official portfolio, ministry portfolio for, I think it was the Ministry of Environment and Agriculture, and then they added climate change. You can fact check me, but, you know, it became a part of a ministerial portfolio, which I think was significant in Jamaica. At the time, being in Jamaica, I told myself, I said, this was at the forefront of government sort of responding. So there was a significant amount of resources, or at least, you know, brain energy that went into thinking about climate change. You know, they launched a lot of campaigns working with young people to get them, you know, Jamaica's big for music. So to get them to create music around climate change, and to kind of increase the community's awareness about climate change and the extent of the problem. Now, so that's governmental stuff. Again, how that filters down to the fishing community At the time I was in Jamaica, that wasn't materialized as yet, right? And you still, of course, local people always have a mistrust of government because they don't believe that government, you know, actually does stuff for them. That was one of the things, that the government wasn't there. They wanted help with their livelihoods and the government wasn't there. And so that's, I think, something that that has to be followed up. You know, like, how is the government really investing local resources in order to assist with livelihoods that have been devastated by climate change?
When you talk about local Indigenous participation in the climate change discussion, are you seeing that? Like, because that could like add just a different nuance and try to be a little bit more strategic and effective if we were to integrate those that Indigenous knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that is one area of research that I think is really needed, right? Trying to understand, how are we utilizing layperson, everyday person knowledge? Like, one of my, you know, research projects, you know, in Jamaica particularly, have this population, which is called the Maroon population. And I consider the Maroon population sort of the indigenous population of Jamaica, given, you know, their history of being, you know, formerly enslaved and then, you know, escaping from slavery, et cetera, and forming their own communities in the mountainous regions of Jamaica. And so they have survived. And so in order to survive, they had to utilize the physical environment. And so the question for me in looking at that indigenous knowledge is, well, how were they able to survive, right? Utilizing the environment? What is their environmental ethic and worldview? And I'm still doing that research. And then the next step from that would be to understand, well, how are those worldviews incorporated in everyday contemporary activism? You know, is there some type of, you know, worldview of, you know, decoloniality or something within the environmental activism framework that could then be used in order to spew climate change sort of work forward, right, in order to get in communities to adapt to climate change or to engage in sort of resiliency within the climate change realm.
Colonialism in U.S. United States. So I just know with this administration, the Biden administration, they are trying to reaffirm their commitment to fight against climate change and make it a top foreign policy priority. And we're starting to see that within the government. Various offices are becoming larger, the environmental office.
Look, the climate crisis is not our fight alone. It's a global fight. The United States accounts, as all of you know, less than 15% of carbon emissions. The rest of the world accounts for 85%. That's why I kept my commitment to rejoin the Paris Accord, because if we do everything perfectly, it's not going to only matter. I kept my commitment to convene a climate summit right here in America with all the major economies of the world, China, Russia, India, European Union. And I said I'd do it in my first 100 days. I want to be very blunt about it. Attempt was to make sure
it's refreshing that the world could see there was a consensus and to see a federal administration sort of put environmental justice on the front burner and say, okay, we're going to launch this Justice 40 initiative and we're going to engage in ensuring that we prioritize marginalized communities within our nation state. So that is refreshing. The backside of that is that I think the administration needs to get their act together in really trying to figure out how do you implement this really bold statement, and, you know, not show the public that they don't know what they're talking about. You know, we look at some of the conversations with WeJack and, you know, trying to figure out, okay, well, you know, is the climate justice screening tool actually coming out? You know, what does this look like? Is this the best way to be able to address climate change? You know, what do you mean by 40% of benefits going to marginalized communities? So there are some things to work out there. So yes, refreshing, but need to get some of those, the act together. On the international front, I think that this is where diplomacy comes in, right? And we, within the Caribbean, I think that the Caribbean needs to continue to act as a bloc and to figure out how do we leverage, you know, all of our voices as one unified region on the international scale, whether that means interacting with the United States, which is, you know, one of our closest neighbors, whether that be with China, whether it be with European allies, what does it mean to be able to stand as a bloc? And that's where sort of like places like CARICOM would come in, et cetera. I think when I think about this notion of a green energy revolution, right, and thinking about, okay, that the United States would like to ensure that we move and push towards green energy because, you know, that is going to help us to move the needle on climate change. I think, yes, it's good that we think about, you know, moving to clean energy, et cetera. I think that we have to be very careful in saying, okay, we're moving towards green energy, but we're going to put that investment in the developing world and tell the developing world that they need to kind of move the needle first. Whereas, you know, in a country like the United States or China, that they continue to burn fossil fuels, you know, into the future, right? You know, I think of the Guyanese context. So Guyana just recently discovered oil and gas off of their offshore, Guyana being, you know, on the South American continent, but considered part of the Caribbean. And, you know, people are kind of freaking out because they're like, you know, who discovers oil in 2000, you know, in the 2000s, right? Oil was discovered, you know, centuries ago, but they discovered oil and they want to develop oil. You know, they want to be able to have an economy based on hydrocarbon because it is still lucrative. And so there we have to ensure that we avoid that hypocrisy of saying, no, you have to leapfrog ahead, right? And go into the green energy, you know, arena without tapping those resources that you all have that have the technology to allow it to be able to develop and then perhaps have some type of social and economic impact for their countries. So those are just some of my thoughts on, you know, the notion of what the US government might be doing that may spew into, you know, the Caribbean context.
Definitely right. I mean, having to put that pressure on the Caribbean to try to push forth with a green economy without having that technology resources, just really unfair. And I mean, that does speak to the neocolonialist attitudes that that these countries have towards the Caribbean. Speaking of that, like, I know you mentioned China. I mean, they're the largest producer and exporter of solar panels and wind turbines, and they're really trying to they are at the forefront of this in terms of production, manufacturing products that's for renewable energy. So I'm just curious to know, like, is China or have you, what's your opinion about China working with these Caribbean nations to address climate change? And do you see there's being competition between the United States and China in terms of political and economic influence in the Caribbean?
Mm-hmm. So,
what's your opinion?
Yeah. Yes. One of the first things I would say is that within the Caribbean, I think green technology, particularly in renewable energy, is still not so much new, but it's still an emerging sector. There are some countries that are actually really good at it. Like I think Barbados is well known for solar panels. They're way ahead of the game with respect to that. Dominica, I think, also has some solar and maybe some geothermal there. But it's not as widespread. So like, for example, in Trinidad and Tobago, we haven't adopted, solar energy, which we know people are like, oh, you should, because, you know, you're tropical and you have access. But again, recognizing that the technology itself, there is a cost associated with it. And for a country like Trinidad, that would have been dependent on fossil fuels, moving to green energy, there's not necessarily an incentive there unless you have a visionary or someone who, you know, is pioneering to see, okay, that these two things can coexist until we make green energy cheaper than fossil fuel, right? So they have to coexist to some extent. So that's the first thing. I think that the geopolitics between China and the United States as it plays a role in the Caribbean is really interesting. I would say recently, China probably would be considered a closer ally to some extent in the Caribbean in terms of economic opportunities and funding. And the reason for that is because, you know, the United States would have been the main sort of proponent and supporter of the IMF and the World Bank, right? And at one point, that's where the Caribbean would go to for their international funding and for their loans and those kinds of things. But we have seen that the IMF and the World Bank have basically devastated, the economy of some countries. Jamaica is a perfect example. There's a good film called Life and Debt that really highlights some of the, the negative economic impacts of, you know, structural adjustment policies from the IMF and the World Bank. And so, you know, a lot of governments have sort of looked towards China, which have opened its doors to some extent, as a lender to these countries. So I give two examples. So for example, they didn't come to fruition, but two examples where we would have seen generous loans from China. So in Trinidad and Tobago, they had proposed a smelter for the southern part of the country, and China was the main funder of that. Of course, there was environmental stuff, and eventually it got cancelled. And the same thing with Jamaica. There was with the Panama Canal expansion that was happening, 2013 and thereabouts. They had proposed in Jamaica to expand a logistics hub on two islands off the coast of Jamaica, and China again was not only the main funder, but was the main company that was going to be in charge of producing this logistics hub. And so you see those economic opportunities that are now becoming I want to say the status quo, right, with China sort of being a more amicable player to some extent. I'm not saying that there are cold relations between the U.S. and the Caribbean, but we do see that more and more of Chinese money is coming in into the region.